Professor Gopal, distinguished visitors and participants of the seventh course. Because it is the seventh course, we thought everything would go very smoothly because we have experience of seven previous occasions. But strangely, this year we have had many problems, culminating with the Indian Airlines strike and an air crash, which where fortunately nobody was killed. And I am therefore very happy to see practically all the participants from the government, from the private and the public sector, taking part in this symposium. So therefore, it's a very special welcome I give to you, because I know people have gone through many hazards of travel in the last few days. I had made a small journey to Madras and came back, but even the train was 6 hours late, and we were not sure whether it's going to come out or not. So it's under those circumstances. Now, once again, we are very grateful that Professor Gopal is with us. He's inaugurates almost regularly for us, and therefore it's clear that we appreciate his contributions to this particular course. His great knowledge of history, current affairs, and Delhi is a good start-off point for our discussions, which, as you will hear from Dr. Kapoor, takes you to as much knowledge as possible. But it's our idea to pass this on to you and get knowledge back from you, because you're all very senior people, much experience, and we somehow feel that that knowledge is lost and this coupling has to be made, and that is the essential philosophical purpose of this get-together. Now, I will not take too much time. I was hoping that by the time I would finish, Mr. Gorbade of the Karnataka Ministry would be here, because he sent word to say he was coming. But our traditions are we can wait for about 5 to 10 minutes. 10 minutes is approaching, so we'll start the proceedings. Thank you very much.
Dr. Ramana, Professor Gopal, distinguished participants, ladies and gentlemen, I join Dr. Ramana in welcoming you all to this course, the seventh course, and to our institute. It is my pleasure to introduce you all to what this institute is all about and what this course is about in particular. The overall aim of the institute is to establish a multidisciplinary approach to the problems of the nation. In the 20th century, one faces a strange dilemma. The very distinguished Professor S. Gopal. And it is my pleasure to introduce Professor Gopal to you more formally. Professor Gopal is the Emeritus Professor of Contemporary History at the JNU. He is a DPhil and DLit from Oxford. He was awarded the Honorary DLit from Andhra, Banaras, and Tirupati Universities. He is a Fellow of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and a corresponding Fellow of the Royal Historical Society. He received the Sahitya Akademi Award in 1976, was elected the President of Indian History Congress in 1978, and is the author of several books on modern Indian history, including a very well-known three-volume biography of Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, biography of his own illustrious father, Professor Radhakrishna, and a very important edited book, which is very topical right now, The Anatomy of a Confrontation, and this is on the Babri Masjid Ram Janmabhoomi issue. It is my great pleasure to invite Professor Gopal to deliver his inaugural lecture. But before I do that, it is also our tradition to ask the teacher or the professor or the expert who is inaugurating the course to sign in our golden book to formally mark the inauguration of the course. So I take this opportunity of requesting Professor Gopal to sign our golden book introducing, starting this particular seventh course.
Dr. Kapoor, participants in the seventh course and friends. It's a great privilege for me to be back here this morning and to sign the Golden Book inaugurating the seventh course. As Dr. Ramana has reminded me and mentioned to all of you, I have been a regular participant in these courses. And as I recollect, the only courses I've missed are when Indian Airlines came in the way. So it is a great pleasure for me to be back here today and to speak on a topic which is obviously of very great current significance and interest, that is national identity, a historical perspective. I'd like at the start, because obviously what concerns all of us is the Indian national identity in historical perspective. But to understand that, I would like at the start to etch in very rapidly the theoretical background and the general context of the rise and growth of national identities. Nations are not a natural social phenomena. They are contrived. They are artificially made and are the product of historical events and circumstances. The concept of a nation is primarily a European idea. Nations first are formed in Europe in the 17th and the 18th centuries and are the outcome of medieval communities under the impact of rationalism, liberal ideas, economic changes, and the growth of various forms of legalism. But if nations are made, nations are more easily made if in the communities in question there is, however loose, a cultural identity. And out of that cultural identity, nations spring. Therefore, and this is obviously something that comes pleasantly to me, history is a very important part of building a national identity. If you have a long historical tradition, particularly a cultural and a social tradition, then nations more easily blossom. But history, as you know, is not something on which everybody is agreed. The past not being there before us, in our interpreting the past, we have different ideas of what we regard is the authentic past. And one of the curious aspects of building a national identity is, it is not necessary that the history on which, if a history does exist, a nation draws, is what most people would regard as the correct or the authentic one. Or to put it another way, historical errors are as important as a true understanding of history in formulating a national identity. And how important history is in making a nation, you can see from a negative example that one of the weaknesses of Pakistan, of the national identity of Pakistan, is because they deliberately disown much of what is a part of their history, and therefore it is that the national identity of Pakistan is always extremely weak and in danger of collapse. I said that history, and European history in particular, is the background of the forming of national identities. And it is not only a concept of Europe, it is a very recent concept of Europe. It only really dates from about the 17th and the 18th centuries. Take Britain, for example. You only get a national British identity from the Act of Union of England and Scotland in 1707. Britain only comes into existence in the early part of the 18th century. And that national identity is strengthened not only by the wars that Britain waged right through the 18th century with France and Spain, but afterwards, of course, that national identity was buttressed by the British drive for empire. If you look, for example, at the songs that go into building the British national identity, Rule Britannia, as well as God Save the King, both only take their origin in the mid-18th century. France comes a bit later. The French national identity develops from about 1789 with the French Revolution, and the French Revolution being carried on the bayonets of Napoleon all over Europe. And it is France facing a coalition of enemies. It is only from then, while you have the nominal term, the geographical term of France, French national identity only dates from about the end of the 18th century. By the 19th century, the idea that one should be a nation, the idea that a cultural community should progress into forming a nation, spreads all over Europe, in Poland, in Hungary, in Italy, and in Germany. But notice the two main aspects of European national identity. One is thought to be ethnic homogeneity, and the other strand is the strand of a single language. It is on the basis of speaking one language and of being a one racial stock that European national identity spreads all over. And this also becomes a part of the theoretical justification. Freeman, for example, the British historian, writing in the mid-19th century, talked of language as the badge of nationality. Max Weber, better known as a sociologist, Max Weber talked of a nation as a community of language and literature. And you therefore have countries like Germany and Italy, countries but not yet nations, but claiming throughout the 19th century that because they speak a single language, German or Italian as the case may be, they should become a nation state. And that happens in the case of both these countries by 1800. And 71. But even when you form a nation with a single language, because it is thought that a nation without one language is a contradiction in terms, even when you have a nation state, sometimes the national identity has to be built on that basis. It is not always that a national identity leads to a nation state. In fact, more often it's the other way. You claim that you should be a single nation with a state because you are ethnically homogeneous and because you speak one language, and on that basis you try and build a national identity. It took long for Germany and Italy, after 1871, to develop a German or an Italian national identity. The famous statement, when the Italian Constituent Assembly met in 1871 to draw up a constitution for a unified Italy, one of the Italian statesmen, a man called D'Azeglio, he got up and said, "We have built Italy, now we must make Italians." I quote that because you will see that it has a considerable relevance when I come to talk about India and the Indian national identity. The paradox of a national identity following the formation of a nation state is not all that uncommon. As against national identity as it has been built in Europe, contrast the development in the United States. The United States has this problem that its history only extends not further back than 1776, because the national identity of the United States does not take into account the history of the indigenous Indians who happened to live there before European settlement came in. But the United States has rejected the idea of a nation being based on ethnic uniformity and a single monolanguage. You have a large number of languages spoken in the United States, and those languages have not been dropped for any one particular language. In fact, even recently, efforts were made by a certain section of United States society to have the English language proclaimed as the official language. And there was so much opposition to it that the idea was dropped. What holds the United States together again? Together? What is the national identity of people living in the United States? The earlier argument used to be that everybody who settles in the United States becomes an American, that the United States is a melting pot. Now, that argument no longer holds, because everybody who settled in America becomes an American but does not merge with the entire community. The popular, and I think the correct argument at the moment, is that the United States is not a melting pot. The United States is a salad bowl. You have everything put into the bowl. They mix, but they do not merge. What then makes an American? America doesn't depend on ethnic homogeneity. It cherishes different languages. But what holds the Americans together is not even a long tradition or a historical background. It is a commitment to certain principles and to certain ideals. It is really in the United States that you find the applicability of the universal values which were stated by the French encyclopedists in the late 18th century. Far be it from me, and I'm sure it would be far from any thinking American, to suggest that America has achieved its goal of an integrated society and a well-entrenched national identity. They have, apart from the problems of the Puerto Ricans and the Mexicans, etc., they have this great problem of how to integrate the African Americans, and which is, of course, obviously not to be done on the basis of ethnic homogeneity. But the United Nations aspires to an integrated national identity on the basis of these values and these principles. That the inhabitants of the United States should be held together, not by blood or by language, but by common aspirations. All men are created equal and are endowed by the Creator with inalienable rights. That is the goal and the objective on which the United States hopes to base its national identity. Now, this, of course, as you will see, is something that is not acceptable to the European cast of mind. Hitler summed it up. Hitler said, when the United States declared war in December 1941, "What is the United States?" said Hitler. "The United States is not a nation. The United States is just a mess." Now, that was Hitler. You see the contrast between the European idea of national identity and the American sense of national identity. And you see the consequences that follow from that. If in Europe you try to build it on the basis of language and ethnic affinity, you have all the problems, the nightmare consequences with which we are faced today. You have this horrendous concept of ethnic cleansing. European nationalism is exclusive, it is reactionary, it is xenophobic. Anybody who does not belong to what they regard as ethnic purity has got to be dispensed with, to be got rid of. And therefore, such nations as were created in Europe after the First World War under the aegis of Woodrow Wilson, those nations are today collapsing. Yugoslavia with absolute bloodshed, Czechoslovakia split by mutual consent. The European concept, therefore, if one may say so, the European concept of national identity is backward-looking. The United States concept of national identity is forward-looking, it is unifying, it is expansive. National identity being built in the United States on the basis of patriotic identification. National identity as a sense of something shared because of your recent social experience, because the history of the United States is not more than 200 years old, making such use as you have of your historical experience, your inheritance, but also held together not so much by a common past as by common ambitions and aspirations. Now here you have two models of national identity, the European and American. Now where does Indian national identity, such as it is, where does it fall? On which side? Indian national identity is also of very recent origin. While we have had in India a general sense of cultural identity, what one might call a sense of Indianness, the idea of a narrowed down Indian national identity really comes as the legacy of the colonial experience. It is only after the British came to India, an India which was a gathering of large and small principalities, and it is after the British introduced administrative and commercial unity and a government whose writ extended throughout the land, it is after that that you begin to get the development in the modern sense of what one might call national sentiment. The Indian middle classes, educated in the English language, use the English language in order to criticize the alien ruler, take advantage of his literature and of the institutions that he has set up in order to establish their own identity. That is, I think, again, the paradoxical consequence of the Indian national movement. I'm afraid we will have to face the fact, however much we may dislike it, that the Indian national identity has been developed on the basis of a vigorous use of the English language. And therefore, the Indian national identity, certainly at the start, till the Mahatma arrived on the scene, the Indian national identity was very much a middle-class identity. The purpose that had been served for Britain by the wars with France and Spain, that had been served for France by the French Revolution during the Napoleonic Wars, that kind of impetus of war has been supplied to India by the national movement. And it is this national movement that has made possible a degree of social mobilization and of political participation which one cannot see being developed otherwise. Now, obviously, when this national sentiment started to grow in India, the British response to this was, this national movement is very hollow. How can India have a national movement? Because India is not a nation. How can you have, they're applying, you see, the European concepts. How can you have a nation when you have so many languages being spoken in India? When you have neither ethnic uniformity nor monolingualism, this does not fall into the straitjacket of nationalism which the British adopted. India, they said, by the very nature of its society, is not a nation and cannot be a nation. And Churchill summed this up, of course, in those years when the early 1930s, when he was indulging in fierce diatribes against the Congress and Mahatma Gandhi, etc. Churchill said, India is not a nation. India is a geographical term. India can no more be a nation than the equator can be a nation. But it is not in the tradition of European national identity that India falls. It is more on the lines of what one sees in the United States. And as compared to the United States, India has this advantage, of course, of an unbroken civilization and long historical traditions and great number of common memories. And that is why, writing in Ahmednagar jail in 1943-44, Nehru defined nationalism, particularly as applied to India. I quote from the Discovery of India. Nationalism, says Nehru, is essentially a group memory of past achievements, traditions, and experiences. Our national identity, and I think it is rightly said, our national identity is to a large extent based on group memories of what has happened in the past. It is not the Freeman or the Weber definition of the nation as born of language and literature that we accept. Rather, if we are looking for a theorist, we turn to the historian Acton, who said that a nation is a moral and political being, that it's a psychological element which is important in nation building and in the forming of a national identity. But is it sufficient merely to have national identity based on the past? You want something to look forward to rather than cling to what has happened before. And here we move on from Acton to the French philosopher Renan, Ernest Renan, who said, and I quote from the French in a loose translation, a nation is a body of people, this is Renan, a nation is a body of people who have done great things together in the past. That's all right, that's Nehru and Acton. Who have done great things together in the past and who hope to do great things in the future. You rely on the past and you look forward to the future. You rely on the past, not in the sense that the European national identity formers look back on the past, but you look back to your group memories and you look forward to what you have achieved or hope to achieve in the years to come. And therefore, you will notice that those who first set out to build our national identity, they have more in common with Lincoln and Jefferson, say, than with the European nation builders like Cavour or Bismarck. The Indian national identity is not based on ethnic exclusiveness or on a fortress mentality guarded by a single language. It is based on this psychological commitment to what you were, and here I must add, or what you think you were in the past. Because as I mentioned earlier, when you look back to group memories, one does not always have the same group memories. What you think you were in the past and what you hope to be in the future. The United States doesn't, of course, have thinking back to the past, but it is this commitment to certain values, to certain principles, and to certain legitimate aspirations, it is that which is the cement of national identity in countries like the United States and India. And here I'd like to say, and this I think is of great importance in the present day, when you look at the Indian national identity, you will notice that contrary to what is often said today, religion is not one of the elements that goes into the building of our national identity. This religious element was brought into the picture by the British. When they saw that Indian national feeling was developing, they countered, as I said, by saying India is not and can never be a nation. If India is not a nation, what is India? According to the British, India was a cluster, a putting together of various religious communities. The British acted on three premises in order to attack and weaken the growth of the Indian national identity. They said that India is a collection of religious communities, primarily the Hindu and the Muslim. Then the British went on, the Hindus and the Muslims cannot and have never got on well in the past. As one British imperialist said, the enmity between the Hindus and the Muslims is always smoldering beneath the surface. In other words, there are always a daggers drawn, and very little is required in order to fan these embers into a fire. And of course, the third premise of the British, but of course they were too clever to state it clearly, the third premise was, these religious communities are always fighting with each other, and that suits the Raj. Because if we want to stay in India, as they hope to do, if we want to stay in India permanently, and here again, Churchill was the one honest man among them. Churchill said clearly, the bulwark of British rule in India is the rioting and the rancor between Hindus and Muslims. One Secretary of State in 1895 made this very clear in his private letters to the Viceroy. Lord George Hamilton wrote in 1895, he wrote to the Viceroy, you know, when the Hindus and the Muslims fight, there is a problem of law and order. When the Hindus and the Muslims get together, there is a threat to the foundations of British rule in India. And then Lord George Hamilton went on to say, I prefer the problems of law and order. Now, this was the attitude of the British. It is the British who tried to demolish the growth of Indian national identity by stating the religious element in India, by promoting religious discord in India. It's all right, the British, you can understand it from their point of view, they are anxious to maintain the Raj. That's their interest. What is tragic is that the Indians also fell into this trap of thinking that Hindus and Muslims can never get on with each other, and instead of thinking of a transcendent Indian national identity, even our leaders began to think in terms of Hindus and Muslims rather than acting, irrespective of their religion, rather than acting as Indians. Look, for example, at the proceedings of the Indian National Congress, 1889, the fourth session of the Indian National Congress. They pass a resolution saying that in all matters that affect religious minorities, as the majority of delegates belonging to the religious minorities must be in favor. In other words, the Indian National Congress, like the British, is encouraging the Muslims to think as Muslims and the Hindus to behave as Hindus, rather than both of them behaving as Indians. This goes on. You come to 1916, the Lucknow Pact. What is the Lucknow Pact? The Lucknow Pact is politicians belonging to the Hindu faith and politicians belonging to the Islamic faith, together put up a joint petition to the British government, saying we Hindus want this, we Muslims want this, we will support each other, rather than saying we Indians, we Muslims or Hindus, we want this. And it is not only the Congress Party's resolutions which matter, there is also a second unfortunate trend, and that is more and more our leaders in the early part of this century are beginning to cast Indian national identity in the molds of religion. Particularly, there is a strong development of Hinduizing Indian nationalism and Hinduizing Indian national identity. Great as these men were, we have to mention this, that this is what Tilak did, this is what Aravind Ghosh did, and this is what, unfortunately, the Mahatma also tended to do. Now, the Mahatma is obviously one of the great figures of human history, and to criticize the Mahatma is in no way to diminish him. His achievements far beyond any criticisms that I or anyone else can make. But the fact remains that as a political leader, in his own way and for his own reasons, which were no doubt most commendable, the Mahatma also talked about, in the Khilafat campaign, for example, he didn't say that all Indians should ask for the support to restore the Caliph. What he said was, the Muslims want the restoration of the Caliphate, and all we Hindus must support them. Again, when the Mapla rebellion took place in Malabar in 1921, there were a lot of various reasons that went into it. Economic, social, political. But everybody tended loosely to think of it as a rebellion of the Muslims. And so did the Mahatma, strange to say. Because Gandhi said, when one heard of, when there were newspaper reports of alleged atrocities committed by the rebels in Malabar, Gandhi didn't say all Indians should be ashamed. He said, I think all Muslims should be ashamed of what has happened in the Mapla rebellion. The result, therefore, is inadvertently the Congress supporting the thinking and approach of the British, and of course you get all the developments that you get from the period 1900 and from the period 1920, but basically from 1937. Because as against this, as against the British machinations and the Congress short-sightedness and the weakness of our Indian national leaders, the other thing to remember is that long before the British came to India, we have had many religions in India. Into the sense of Indianness, which is one of the building blocks of the Indian national identity, into the Indian general structure of feeling, into that religion did not play much of a part. We had many people of many religions living in India from time immemorial. They had this weakness that they didn't eat together, they didn't intermarry, they kept separate. But you didn't get an integrated Indian society. You got a disparate Indian society. You got the people belonging to the Islamic faith and the people who claim to be Hindus living separately, living peacefully, but not really merging. And this, of course, was one of the weaknesses of Indian society of which the British took advantage. But granted that, one of the prime elements of a secular state is that religion is a private matter for the individual. And while you had some quarrels in the earlier period between Hindus and Muslims, you also had quarrels among Hindus and among Muslims. You had some religious bigots among the Hindus as among the Muslim rulers, but of course there are no monocausal explanations in history, as there are no generalizations possible in the relations between various groups. But one of the building blocks is mutual tolerance, even if you do not have full integration. That is not secularism in the full sense, but that is the beginnings of secularism. And therefore, if today religion has become a weakening factor of our national identity, we must remember that this is because we have allowed it to be so. And the general roots that go into the making of our national identity, those roots of tolerance which can lead on to a positive integration, those roots are deep and those roots are not easily damaged. Now, Indian national identity is obviously a matter of great importance to all of us. Any country, be it in Europe or in the United States or here, if you do not have a national identity, you may be a nation, but you will be a cardboard nation. National identity makes possible a community and not just a collection of different individuals or groups. And in India, the national identity, as in the United States, will have to be that in a fundamental way, we all belong to one another, that especially when you have regional pulls, vociferous tendencies, different languages, many religions, national identity is not a flattening, homogenizing process of assimilation, but it is the right to differ within the general right of a common loyalty. It is not a singularity of religions or languages, it is diversity within a general feeling of holding together. Even in economics, as Professor Srinivas, whom I'm delighted to see here this morning, as Professor Srinivas has said, we are micro-regions in that. We have economic micro-regions in India, but that is again no reason why it should weaken our national identity. Now, the building of national identity is never a completed task. I don't think any country anywhere in the world can say that its national identity is beyond weakening or it is firm. Take even the countries of Europe, who were the pioneers in building national identity. Even in seemingly well-established countries, you have national identity being shaken. In Britain, the Union of 1707, the Union of Britain and Scotland, is today again very much in jeopardy. And there's a great demand for Scottish autonomy. The Basques in Spain, Quebec in Canada, the Lombard League in northern Italy, which has just swept the elections, demanding greater lights for Lombardy in the north. And even more so in the West, countries like Britain and France and Germany will have to face the fact which the United States has been facing for a long time, and that is this new vast influx of minorities of different ethnic stock from the Caribbean, the Arabs and the Algerians in France, and the Turks in Germany. A new kind of national identity is demanded in these countries. And of course, in India, the problem is being accentuated. In 1947, we lost the territorial imperative for our national identity. Churchill said in the 30s, as I mentioned to you, India is a geographical term. In 1947, even that ceased to be so. And we had to pick up the broken pieces and put together again a fresh jigsaw of national identity. And this business of strengthening the national identity is a problem that has continued right through the years of independence. Professor Srinivas has written an article on nation building in independent India, the building of national identity on the basis of a partitioned country, has been going on since 47. We seem to be successful in the early 50s, but since then, of course, our national identity has been under severe assault. We have the problems of the peripheral areas in the northeast, the problems of Kashmir and the Punjab. One explanation given and I speak, of course, with great trepidation in the presence of sociologists, but one explanation given is that before 47, we had the luxury of a common enemy. We had the British to face. Now that the British have gone, there's a feeling in these peripheral areas that what the sociologists call official nationalism, nationalism as understood in the centers of power in Delhi and elsewhere, this is being imposed on people who have things and interests and antecedents which are very different. So obviously, one of the problems in the light of the historical perspective, one of the problems of keeping going the national identity of India is to tackle afresh this question of what can take the place of the national movement. What is it that can hold our national identity together? So obviously the roots of national identity, if it is developing on the lines we want it to do, have to be well nourished. The various ways of doing it, one is of course that our democracy should become not a distorted, isolated democracy, but a full, vigorous, and a healthy polity. We must again strengthen, as I mentioned earlier, the strands of secularism in our historical tradition as adapted to present-day circumstances. Economic development, of course, will go a long way to sink beneath the surface those forces that eat at the roots of our national identity. But more important than all that, obviously, to keep our national identity strong and firm, we need a proper kind of education. Now, this has always been understood, but what kind of education? In the 18th and the 19th centuries in Europe, and this again is another reason why we cannot follow blindly the European concepts of national identity. In Europe, they thought, you must teach your children to have a national identity. Even the best and the most liberal of their thinkers thought in these lines. Rousseau, for example, I quote Rousseau, we must teach our people, writes Rousseau, that education is intended to make every child a patriot by inclination, by passion, by necessity. On first opening his eyes, a child must see his country, and until he dies, he must see nothing else. Feature again in Germany. Germany shall be willed into existence by education. Now that is not our concept of education. We don't want to indoctrinate a national identity into our boys and girls. But what we must do in our education, obviously, is not merely to clear the past from the cobwebs of myth, but we must also teach our children what are the values by which India has lived, how has Indian society evolved, what are the good and the bad things about the course of that evolution, and what are the tasks which confront us. And if we can do that, then a national identity that has been built on the basis of a middle-class movement, the national movement, at the lead. By the time you come to the 30s, the Indian national movement is beginning to seep down among the masses, thanks primarily to the Mahatma. We must take advantage of that in order to make our children think on the right lines and appreciate what is the real sound national identity that our country requires. And that will be the byproduct of our education rather than a direct positive inculcating what Rousseau and Fichte suggest. Because essentially, whether it be in Europe with its ideas of national identity or even more so in the United States and coming back to our immediate problem in our own country. National identity can only grow. It can be helped by secularism, by economic growth, and by democracy. But basically what it requires is the byproduct of education, and that is, historical perspective shows that in all these countries where national identity has withstood whatever storms might have hit it, it can only be on the basis of an emotional integration, which is best achieved not directly, but by the indirect consequences of a proper type of education. Thank you.
What is given us is to ask questions. There's still time before tea, and I now request the audience to make their comment. Yes, here you are. Just hold this while you are, because it is being recorded.
May I, on behalf of myself, express my deep admiration for this lecture, which was really very, very stimulating and put our problems in a kind of perspective which is really, you know, wonderful. And I must say, speaking for myself again, that I learnt a good deal from it. But I can't let this opportunity go without asking Professor Gopal a question which I am quite certain he has thought about. Some months ago, Eric Hobsbawm, whom he knows very well, speaking to the American Anthropological Association, Chicago, I think, he said, I think developing a thesis we had developed in his latest book on nationalism, that nationalism is today under attack by two forces. One is ethnicity, and the other is the supranational formation, such as is emerging in Europe. I think he's speaking from the European experience, and he's also thinking of the breakup of East European nations into communities, and particularly the collapse of Russia. Would you like to say something on this, Professor Gopal?
It's, of course, a very distinguished historian. And what he says is always to be considered seriously. But basically, I think, as Professor Srinivas said, Hobsbawm is thinking as a European and in the European context. Now, what has happened in Europe is, as I tried to point out earlier, is that the European concept of national identity is coming home to roost. And because they have been going on this arrogant, exclusive, xenophobic wave of saying that a nation is ethnic and a nation is monolinguist, therefore, the efforts which Woodrow Wilson, on the basis of his American experience, tried to bring into Europe by the formation of these multilingual, multi-ethnic states, they have started breaking up. And we are really getting the European concept taken to its extreme atrociousness, and such as we see in the splitting up of Yugoslavia and in the ethnic cleansing in the whole of the Balkans and the cutting up of Bosnia and the breakup of Czechoslovakia, etc. That, I think, is not a problem which the United States faces, and that is fortunately not yet a problem which we in this country face. And I think one of the, when one is looking back on the first 20 years of Free India, when one looks at all the grave mistakes that our governments then committed, at least on the right side, was this question of the formation of linguistic provinces, which with all its drawbacks, and as you know, Nehru was never in favor of it, yet it has managed to stem this business of separatist movements forming on the basis of linguistic autonomy. And therefore, I think Hobsbawm's first point is not applicable to India. That is true of his article, and it is also true of the book that Professor Srinivas has mentioned. He is looking at the European problem in the European context from a European point of view. And the second thing is, of course, these, what Hobsbawm talks about, the supranational states coming into existence. Now, since Hobsbawm wrote, and since he spoke in Chicago, he has again been proved wrong, because I think one of the major developments in Europe, particularly in the last 12 months, has been how weak is the European community and how strong are the blind, backward-looking nationalist forces that are prevailing in Europe. It is not only small Denmark that threw out the Maastricht Treaty. It was even France that accepted it only by the width of a whisker. And of course, Switzerland is not in. Switzerland has always been isolated, but Switzerland also is not in favor of it. And therefore, you see the retrograde nationalist identity is still strong in Europe. Europe has this problem that economically she's forced to form a community and have a common market and a common free trade area, etc. Politically, her people are nowhere mature enough to accept that economic drawing together. The centrifugal economic forces and the centripetal economic forces and the centrifugal political forces, that is really the clash in Europe, and I'm not sure that the economic forces will prevail. So Habsburg obviously is a very, very distinguished historian and thinker, but if I may say so, I don't think that his arguments apply to India. We are neither faced by a supranational force, nor is our national identity of the type that Habsburg has in mind.
With particular reference to Khilafat, I think there was a much greater mistake that was committed at the time of making the constitution. Instead of adopting again the American definition of secularism, which said that the state will have nothing to do with religion, that was a compulsion in America because the original American colonies were established as a result of strong sectarian impulses. And if they had to coexist together in a salad bowl state, they had to ensure that religion will not interfere with the state. Unfortunately, in India, the definition of Sarvadharma Samabhava as secularism has caused a considerable amount of damage. First of all, it is an impractical proposition to say that somebody values all religions equally. I think that may be possible for an individual, that is not possible for the state or communities as a whole to do. Secondly, given the universal franchise and the compulsions of political mobilization, and the state, especially the Indian constitution, having put in four articles of how state can intervene in religion, we let loose the tendency for political mobilization to make use of religion as the primary channel of social communication. And we also permitted the religion-based parties to function openly in the society. Therefore, unless if we want Indian identity, that can be achieved only if we give up this Sarvadharma Samabhava as a definition of secularism, which I think is humbug. But we clearly redraw our constitution and separate totally religion from the state, and also prevent religion-based parties functioning openly in our society.
First, I'll respond to Subramaniam and then come to Professor Ranganathan. Well, I think it is true that at the time of constitution making, a number of errors were made. And taking your last point first, they should have banned communal political parties. And the Constituent Assembly, in fact, passed a resolution saying that all communal political parties should be banned. And the government accepted that resolution. And then, this won't surprise Professor Subramaniam because this is so common in India. The government said, we'll implement this resolution. And the government sent it to the Law Ministry. And the Law Ministry sat on it since then. And the Law Ministry saying, repeatedly the Law Ministry asked, why are you sitting on it? And the Law Ministry said, we are unable to find a definition of a communal political party. So this was the reason why the correct sentiments of the Constituent Assembly, as accepted by the government and as restated by Professor Subramaniam, never got off the ground. I'm not trying to justify it. I'm telling you what happened. And this question of, in the Constitution, they made mistakes. Yes, I agree with you. See, what happened was that there is no dictionary definition of secularism. There is no definition of secularism accepted in every part of the world. In the Soviet Union, secularism was defined as atheism. For 70 years, the Soviet Union tried to spread the doctrines of atheism, and of course that collapsed. Today again, church bells are ringing all over what used to be the Soviet Union. I think Bernard Shaw said this long ago. Bernard Shaw said this even in 1931, when he came back from a visit to the Soviet Union. Journalists asked him, "What do you think of the Soviet Union?" And Shaw said, "They have tried to throw God out of the door, and God is coming back through the windows." And that was in 1931. In 1991, of course, God has come back with a vengeance. Now, what this shows is that whether you like it or not, the religious impulse is deeply embedded in most men and women, and you can't get rid of it so easily. Now, that definition of secularism as adopted by the Soviet Union cannot apply to us. In Europe, the definition of secularism is a very narrow one, formulated in France, what the French call laicization. That is, keep the Catholic Church out of education. Now, that's a legitimate demand, but is obviously not a demand that will cover everything that happens in India. Now, in India, the constitution makers had to deal with this question of the religious strand is very strongly embedded in this multi-religious society, whatever your religion is. Therefore, you don't have a one-sentence definition of secularism. You have a pragmatic, empirical understanding of socialism, that religion should be kept out of public affairs. It's a private matter for the individual, that everyone is equal before the law, that religion shall not come in the way of your taking up any profession, trade, or employment, and that the state should be neutral among all religions. And in this four-category splitting up of secularism, this business of all religions being equal doesn't come in. It's only a question of religion has nothing to do with the state, nothing to do with public life, religion has nothing to do with employment. But the problem, of course, is in this implementation. And I agree with Professor Subramaniam that it might have been would have been a good thing if they didn't have these clauses in the Constitution about protection of institutions of minorities, etc. And of course, the big flaw in Indian secularism is that you do not have equality before the law, in the sense that women belonging to the Islamic faith do not have the same rights after the Hindu law code as the women belonging to Hinduism have. And of course, the other great flaw in the Constitution is that they put in the directive principles of state policy the banning of cow slaughter. Now, the Mahatma was against that. The Mahatma said we should not ban cow slaughter because it is acceptable to a large number of Indians, be they Muslim or be they living in the northeast frontier areas. Nehru also, from a different point of view, said, "I don't believe in the banning of cow slaughter. I don't think there's anything special about the cow." Somebody asked him, "Is there nothing special about the cow?" And Nehru said, "No, I prefer the horse." But be it Gandhi or be it Nehru, they both were agreed that the banning of cow slaughter should not be one of the directive principles of state policy. But Nehru and his government were weak enough to allow it to be put in. The characteristic explanation of Nehru to this, all right, you put what you like in the directive principles of state policy, I shall see that it's never enforced. And as you know, it has never been enforced anywhere by the states or the central government. But I think I agree, if I may say so, with Professor Subramaniam on this, that you are jettisoning principles because you know that you can see that they are never violated in practice. But still, it's a surrender of principle, and more, of course, this question of the Hindu law code and keeping it only to those of the Hindu faith. Now, Why did they do this? I'm not trying to give a justification again. I'm giving an explanation. They did this because they thought that the emotions of the Muslims were still tender and bruised after the partition, and that it could come later. That the Constitution would state certain principles generally. The implementation can be in phases, and that, of course, as you know, it was a bad lapse, because what was possible in 1950 is certainly not possible in 1990. So, on the whole, I agree with Professor Subramaniam that probably secularism would have been stronger in India if the constitution makers had taken a firmer line, both in stating those principles and in implementing them. As for Professor Ranganathan's question, yes, it's true, I didn't mention China and Japan, and that is because the Chinese and the Japanese tend, by and large, to follow the European rather than the American model. They have, of course, the advantage, as in Europe, they have the advantage of a single language, whatever the number of dialects in China. Still, you have the Chinese language and you have the Japanese language, they only one language. They are also, and I say it without meaning to be pejorative, they are also rather exclusive. They are, the Japanese in particular, their national identity is built on their long phase of militarism in the first half of the 20th century. The Chinese also. This might be my view, but I think the Chinese also have a long tradition of expansionism. Contrast the way in which the Chinese are behaving in Tibet to the way in which the United States and India behave. They are trying to flatten out Tibet and to assimilate Tibet and to wipe out Tibetan culture and to merge it with the rest of China. That's the European precedent. That's not the precedent of these larger countries of the United States and India.
I had the pleasure to hear your lecture at Jamshedpur a couple of years back. Today I have a small question. It is in relevance to the Babri Masjid and Ram Janmabhoomi issue. A person of your stature could give us a little light on this subject. Is it relevant to ask this question?
On the subject of the Ram Janmabhoomi?
Yeah, Babri Masjid issue. Now, whether the Supreme Court has to take the decision or the Constitution or a little knowledge on this issue can help us a lot.
Well, I'll tell you what I think of the Ram Janmabhoomi issue as it stands at the moment. And I've been airing my views left, right and center so that my position I would have thought by now it's fairly clear. But I'll deal with the two specific issues. The first issue is this. I think it is immaterial whether there was a temple there or not. If Babur destroyed a temple or had a temple destroyed in 1528, we do not revert to the practices of the Middle Ages. The country has moved on 450 years. We regard ourselves as a civilized country in the throes of the process of modernization. And it is absolutely of no relevance whether he destroyed a temple or not and why he destroyed it. Frankly, I myself think that there is no evidence to suggest firmly that there had been a temple in that area. Even if there had been a temple and it was destroyed, it doesn't follow that it was destroyed for reasons of bigotry. Babur in particular was not a religious bigot. Even a man like Aurangzeb, when he destroyed temples, he destroyed it for various different reasons. Human motivation is not a single strand matter. If you look at the temples that Aurangzeb destroyed, you will find that he destroyed the temples in those areas which were in political revolt. Now, there have been many Hindus who have destroyed Hindu temples. There have been Hindus who have destroyed Buddhist temples, Jaina temples. Hindus and Buddhists and Shaivites and Vaishnavites have quarreled, just as Sunnis and Shias have quarreled. Even more so Baba, because we have sufficient evidence that in many places Baba helped. He gave grants to Hindu holy men and these sadhus and these sons, etc. So that we have no evidence that Baba destroyed a temple. His activities in other fields suggest that he may not have destroyed this temple. Even if he did, I don't think we can go around now correcting the real and the supposed wrongs of the past. Sane people in the 20th century don't do that kind of thing. And if we regard ourselves as a sane people, then I think there can be no semblance of justification whatsoever for the destruction of the mosque. Secondly, I'm rather puzzled as to why this matter should have been referred to the Supreme Court. Because the Supreme Court is supposed to be a body of lawyers. They're not a body of historians or archaeologists. And I don't see how their opinion makes any difference whatsoever. And the other thing, of course, is that under this section under which this thing has been referred to the Supreme Court, it's only an opinion. So the result is going to be that all those who don't like that opinion are going to say, well, there's no reason why we should accept it. This is not a judgment. This is an arbiter dictum. So I really think that the mosque has been destroyed. We should all be ashamed of that, whatever our political complexion and whatever our general viewpoint. What do we do now? I think that if we allow the opinion of a few fanatics to determine what is to be the policy of this country, then goodbye to our national identity. I think that's the end of India as we know it, and as we hope to see India develop.
Well, I don't think there is time for any further questions. We have to keep to our schedules. I just want to make one comment, and that is, Professor Gopal, myself, M. N. Srinivas, Subramaniam, we all belong to what Professor Gopal called influenced by the middle classes national identity, which he specially referred to. But what worried me was, he said, the way you get out of that is through education. Of course, education is a great word, but education in India means something very different. And if anything, it is in education we have failed in the last 50 years to build up whatever identity or even progress. I just make the comment and stop. Except I'd like to quote a person who normally is not easily quotable, and that is Homi Bhabha, was talking about secularism at some stage at a meeting, not a public meeting. He wasn't very fond of addressing the public. And he said, oh, we'll get rid of all these religious tension by propagating science. And then people will become rational. Now, this has not happened. This is not going to happen either. But then when much later somebody said, well, that's what the Russians are doing. They're trying to be logical and propagating science in the hope of getting rid of all these various differences between people. This is pointed out as saying that is the mistake the Russians are making. They're not teaching them to be logical and be scientific, but they're going through Marxism. And that's not logical. I don't know, this statement was made at some meeting quite some time ago, but it occurred to me that I mentioned this again. Anyway, on your behalf, on my own, we thank Professor Gopal for a very stimulating morning, a very topical one, and sometimes a depressing thought too. Thank you.